Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We need to bring in someone who can carry their weight. And I know this person can because she's been on before. She's fantastic. Her name is Lorraine Sommerfeld. She's the author of Motherload. She is an auto columnist with driving.ca. And we'll get to this a little bit later. Got a novel coming out, Lorraine. You're doing everything.
We have everything.
Everything is good. Everything is good. I applaud everything. That's hey, speaking of everything, let's start with the one thing that you can answer that, you know, I think we need to deal with this first. I just earlier today read a story that, I'm going to make it more appropriate for family time radio than it is, but in Germany, two men in a sauna, one ended up stabbed 11 times because they somehow got into a heated discussion about the size of, you know, them, their things. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, is there anything that women argue about like this? Or is it just us? Is there anything in the world that you guys would get that upset about comparing?
No, I really don't think so, unless maybe it's, you know, our spouses. No, like honestly. And I like the idea of a heated discussion in a sauna. Nice work, Scott.
Well, it is. So the story goes, and again, this seems to be maybe the most ludicrous story of the week. They were in the sauna, and one of them, for some reason, and guess what? Beer was involved, not all that surprisingly. One of them apparently poured a beer over the rocks, which led to somehow, how does pouring beer over the sauna rocks lead to a discussion about the length of your thing? But it somehow did. And one of them ended up being stabbed.
I mean, if you jump up, you're angry that someone's wrecking the sauna, you jump up, your towel falls off. Maybe we can go there. But
that's a Seinfeld episode.
It's got to be the ultimate insult you can throw at a male. Who cares about that? So maybe, maybe there's a little bit of that in place. I don't know.
I guess,
like saying that my truck's bigger than your truck.
Yeah, I could see. It seems like, and look, I don't want to be just dumping on my side of the argument here, but it seems like this is not something that women, I've never heard. I'm sure there's comparisons, but I've never heard women getting into a fight about the size of certain parts of their body. I mean, have you ever heard of that?
I think women can be cutting and bitchy about things like that, but I think this is more, the last few years has made everybody really rattled and really angry. You probably see this when you're driving. People are just angry and on edge. And I think it's playing out in a lot of ways that we didn't see it previously. But the world is getting madder. Like there's just a lot of rage. And I think it's really unfortunate because there's kids that haven't grown up not knowing it like that. And today, like if someone's pulled over by the side of the road, you know how we used to stop and help? I will never do that now. I will call for help, but I have no idea who's setting me up. So I think we're turning to a mirror place in general.
And I don't disagree with
stabbing
that.
Over that.
Well, this is obviously the most ludicrous scenario. I don't disagree with you though, about the idea that we are cranky. We are absolutely crankier for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I don't know why they keep showing up on my Twitter feed or something, but just this week, I've been getting all these videos that come across of like random attacks in the States, and people are pointing these things out as, I don't know, there's a Twitter something, and I don't know how I ended up on it because I never looked it up, but and you're looking going, what is going on with people? Like it does sometimes seem, not necessarily with stabbing because you're Don Johnson is bigger than the other guys or smaller, but it does seem like we are mad about an awful lot of things.
But I think you touched on something really important. You say it came across your Twitter feed, which we all know has been warped and changed and destroyed. Twitter is just ridiculous. I mean, the stuff that's coming in now that Musk has let in is nuts. But also, are we being exposed to this because social media is doing that? We have access to stuff. Remember when you were a kid, if a little kid went missing and your parents would be freaked out, it was because it was a kid down the street or maybe in the next town. By the time my kids were young, it was a kid in Australia would go missing. Now no one in Canada is allowed to walk to school. So I think that social media and media in general has changed the way we look at things. And a lot of times it's a very outrageous response to a lot of things. Flip side, people getting beat up and someone filming it, we've turned into monsters.
This one, and this story that I saw, and I don't know why it came up this week, honestly, but it was a story out of Houston where a guy robbed a woman who had just withdrawn some money from the bank. And it was video where he picked her up, and it's horrible. He picked her up and threw her on her head, and she ended up paralyzed. And this happened some time ago, because now I found a follow-up story. I did become intrigued, and there was a news story about her recovery. So this is a while back, and yet it's the same thing. I thought the same thing. Why are you on your phone filming this rather than trying to stop him from doing this?
And I think we've also become fearful. Julie Lalonde is a Canadian woman who teaches how to do interventions, because if you see a domestic feud going on, how do you help? How do you step in? You have to make sure of your own safety. And because so many people are armed and drugs are such a problem that you may not know about, we've gone from people who are generally caring and hopeful and helpful to people who are too scared because we don't know what's going to happen. And I really think as that plays out with the crankiness, with drugs and guns and people generally turtling, going into their house and locking the door and saying, it's not me today. And when we see something horrible, instead of thinking, how can we solve this properly? We think, okay, these are the reasons why that couldn't have happened to me. And that's a very human response. It's a very normal thing to find ways to excuse yourself from being at the center of that. But it's not going to solve anything. It's going to keep getting worse until it finally does land in your lap, and then you have to do something.
Well, speaking of laps, I know why this thing in Germany didn't happen to me, because I don't go into a sauna and get into an argument about that stuff, which is probably the wisest course to take. If you are ever in a German sauna and your towel falls off, just stay silent. Retreat to the corner and stay silent, and you're probably going to be safest. Lorraine, we've heard lots in the last week and a little bit about the whole thing with the Chinese fiddling around in our elections or not or whatever, and whether there'll be an inquiry, and about David Johnson, all the rest. That stuff, we're not going to talk about that stuff per se. I want to talk about something that was like a small little peripheral almost item that was mentioned this week by the Prime Minister. And that is, among all the other things that he said he was going to be doing, one of them was $5.5 million more, because this was something that's been done before. $5.5 million more is going to be spent to battle misinformation. And I'm wondering if you think this can possibly work. And the reason is not because we don't have the technology to make it work. We do. But who determines what is misinformation?
Well, that's the $5.5 million question.
Five and a half, at least.
At least. I don't know how you chase this rabbit down. Like, it is so far out of, it's gone. And we can go way back to the beginning when places like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, let's go to Facebook first, by allowing any information to be out there in any way, shape, or form, when do you put the lid back on that? Like, how do you stop doing that? And to know that other countries and our countries as well, we're also perverting that on purpose around elections especially, but day to day, there's campaigns that have far more might and far more money going in this direction that I don't see how any government is going to stop it going in the other direction. And I know that consumers, news consumers, have lost faith in everybody. I write for two very different newspapers, and I've written for most of them. Who believes this anymore? I don't know who believes what. It's so difficult. And I used to be able to help people absorb news, people that didn't think they were maybe politically literate or something. I could at least give them a starting point. Now I throw my hands up and go, I don't know. It's all coming from Murdoch. People don't realize most of their news is coming from one source, even if they get it from 10.
But even if it's government given, like even if it comes the most apparently the most authoritative government things, I always go back as an example to the early days of COVID. All right, when we didn't know everything that was going on, and Dr. Tam would be there and would say, you know what, don't wear a mask, and then later said, oh no, you should wear a mask. and said, we can't, we shouldn't close the borders. And then we said, oh yeah, we should close the borders. And look, I'm not arguing that she was being malicious. What I'm saying is sometimes stuff changes. But if we now have this rule that says, if we don't agree, if we, whoever the we is, think that you're spreading misinformation, what happens when we find out it wasn't misinformation?
Well, I think with that COVID example especially, is science is supposed to change its mind. That's the whole point. As soon as this became politicized, which there was no way it was not going to be, this is a global thing. Like, and there's, for people that are wondering, conspiracy, you get all those countries to agree on something at the same time, it's never going to happen. But I think as soon as it became politicized, the messaging changed and the people we thought we could look to. I used to think the CDC was phenomenal. I'd done some work and needed them years and years ago. I look at them now and I think it's a crap show because they became politicized. And so you're absolutely right. We're supposed to get messaging from people we can trust. Who do we trust now? Science is supposed to change his mind. That's not a gotcha. If someone in, you know, who's really good at this says, okay, this is what we believe today, and then they turn around a week later and say, okay, no, this has changed, that doesn't make them stupid. That makes them the people who are following the science and they expect it to change. Our problem is we want pat answers,
right?
And politicians demand them. Politicians have to have them.
Let's use another example from COVID. And my argument here is not about COVID per se. It just seems to be a great topic or a great example because everything is going on. We now have credible scientists and credible arms of the US government and others saying, you know, there's a chance that COVID did come from a lab, not from a wet market. So, but back not long ago, if you had put something on Facebook or Twitter saying that it came from a lab, you were marked as this is misinformation. And so again, it seems like whoever holds the lever of power gets to determine what's accurate and what's misinformation. That's kind of a frightening thing.
I think it's whoever is holding the loudest lever of power, frankly, especially in that discussion, because you used to be able to present something and ask questions. You used to be able to say, could it have come from there? And the first thing science is going to do is say, could it have come from there? Could it have? And that will be extrapolated into a 10-second soundbite that says scientists now saying it came from there.
Right.
So that's the other problem. Dumbing things down into a microsecond. No, everyone's got the attention span of a gnat. Nobody will, you know, go and do your work, do your own homework. Oh, I want to slap people that say that. That makes me crazy.
I say it all the time.
But how many people... Not to be, if you're making the point, make your point. I don't have to prove your point. You know, I have to disprove it if I don't agree with you. But I just think we've got ourselves dumbed down to the stupidest common denominator because we refuse to let our minds learn more. It's like we're a sponge that's already soaking wet and there's no room for anything else.
Yeah,
and that is awful. That's,
I mean, look, governments,
it's anti-student.
Well, governments are going to change. We're going to have liberal governments. We're going to have conservative governments. Who knows if we'll have an NDP ever, but governments will change. So it's not about one particular government. But if we now have some sort of rule or law or situation where the government is the one determining what is or isn't accurate, and they're going to have different points of view on different things, we're not really talking about misinformation. That's what you said. We're talking about, well, what is the, this is where we get into what people are really concerned about, which is, can government then block, censor things that it doesn't like under the guise of saying that's misinformation? What if the conservatives get in and there is some information that some liberal person says about Pierre Poilievre that they decide, you know what, that's misinformation, or vice versa. If Trudeau's in and someone offers something and they say, no, that's misinformation, you can't see that anymore. That's really troubling.
I think it's troubling, but it's also been going on for a long time already and globally.
Yeah, but not
it's been going on.
Yes, you're right. Of course you're right, but not with the tacit official stamp of approval of a government saying we are going to do this and spend your money doing this to you.
So what happened to news consumers? What happened to citizens demanding better of these people. I've never seen, I know some people go into politics for very good reasons, but I have seen so many people fail upwards, and I am flabbergasted. I don't understand what is going on. It used to be a duty thing, like people wanted to serve, and now people just want to get reelected. And this is on every stripe. I am not picking one or the other. See it. You know, I think they may get into it with the best intentions, but those are blown out the window in 10 minutes when they find out it's a filthy, filthy business, and it's a business. And I look at consumer, me, you, citizens, we need to be demanding better from. And to your point, are we being blocked from knowing things? Well, we can read science abstracts. We can find voices that are not politicized, but we have to look for them. And guess what? They might be boring people. They might be boring. These aren't people that are going to be on Dancing with the Stars or whatever it's called. So I think we have to stop requiring our news to entertain us and find news that instead informs us.
We got to take a break here. The idea that we're going to have official, I mean, it really, I hate this term because I think it's so cliche, but it does begin to sound a little Orwellian when you start to have official departments of misinformation. In 1980, if you said we're going to have an official department to eradicate misinformation, people would have said, come on, you're reading too many books. And here we are. We started talking, the start of the show today, talking about a ridiculous situation with naked men in a sauna. If people missed it, you're just going to go have to find the podcast. We're not explaining that one again. So this is not supposed to be the all nude show. However, we did see at the Juno Awards this week, a topless protester jump on stage to make her point about this, that, and the other thing. And Avril Lavigne was interrupted and it made a big scene. And now, you know, a bunch of stations are trying to interview her and all the rest. This is the latest in what we've seen, has been going on, as we've seen protesters vandalizing the box in Scotland that holds Braveheart, Rob Roy's sword. And we've seen protesters splash paint and mashed potatoes and stuff on paintings in the Louvre. And does this suggest that this stuff is working, or is it just a crazy, ridiculous thing that people will look at? Because how do you not look at it, but their point is not really being made? Do you think they're getting their point across and making any kind of difference that they think they're making?
If you're getting headlines and cameras on you for your cause, then it's working. And this is also not a new thing. You know this. There's been streakers forever to go to that, the Olympics and stuff. So I think protest, my great grandmother was a protester in England. She was a suffragette. This is not a new thing. Anything that can get attention to your cause, because as you know, we don't respond to, hello, would you mind listening to me talk about my really important thing right now? And you get run over by a truck. So that route doesn't work. We know that. You have to make noise. You have to draw attention to yourself. Is it always for a cause I believe in? Well, no, it's not mine. It's theirs. Does it work? We're talking about it.
Well, we are. But again, that goes to my point. So there's absolutely no question that we are talking about this person, that she has gotten attention, that she's done interviews again. But is what she did achieving anything, I guess, is the bigger question. She's getting attention. And if attention is the end goal unto itself, I suppose she's achieved what she wants. But she seems, we don't know, but she seems to have bigger ambitions of changing the world. Do you think this is changing the world in any way?
You know, when I saw that, the thing that bothered me the most was not that this young woman did this. It was, where's the security?
Well,
are you kidding me? So I tend to look at these things, maybe it's a little more jaded, because I think you want to run around and make noise. Good for you. We need agitators. We need people to make noise. The only way we get change is when we come out of our houses and actually engage. I can sit here and, you know, like a tweet or, you know, write something, but it doesn't change anything. So power to them. They're getting off their butts and doing stuff. But that bothered me because of the danger that could have been involved. Who else could get through that easily? Who else is going to see that? And I'm thinking, come on, Junos, or anyone where this has happened. I know the Oscars were stunned. They were stunned last year, and it took them a year to decide what to do for this year. And that was with two men who totally should have known better, but whatever.
But it's even more than that, though. Think back to, that was ridiculous. That was ridiculous. Yeah. But what happened to Salman Rushdie, where he's speaking at a conference and is stabbed and almost killed and now is permanently disabled? You know, so you're that's, right.
That's the question for me is when these things are about property damage, let's say, it's like Greenpeace stopping the whaling boats and doing whatever they could. And this is decades of this. That's one thing. Somebody walking up to someone who doesn't know they're there and could be a threat, that I have a problem with, that I have a question about. So well, protesting, go ahead and protest, peaceful protest. But I would like security. If I'm on a stage somewhere and someone comes up and does that, I'm not going to end pretty.
I want to get back to the original question in a second, but mm-hmm. just to stick on this for a second, I would have thought that back after 1990-ish, when Monica Seles, the tennis player, had someone come up and stab her in the back in a match, I would have thought that things would have tightened up, not so that everywhere we go, we're walking past a gauntlet of people with machine guns, but that if you are performing somewhere, that there is some expectation you might be safe. Clearly, that's not the case. Levy's not in a lot of places.
No, and we've seen performers on stage from bands and stuff talk people in the audience down from fighting. I think that was Dave Matthews did that a year ago, and because he had the microphone and he saw something break out. I think that's putting a lot on people who that's not their responsibility to do that. And I think it's terrific when they can and they do use that power. But yeah, security for that, that scared me just because somebody could waltz right up there. And it's not just, remember when, is it Kanye or whatever his name is now, got up and yelled at Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just a ridiculous, egocentric arsehole. But anyway, I think when security issues are a prominent deal, then the mom in me gets a little bit more worried about it. But peaceful protest, have at it, do it. I think.
Yeah, I just, I find it, I find it hard to believe, Lorraine, that again, she's getting the attention that she wanted. And maybe this gives her a chance to talk about it, but I have a hard time believing that some premier or prime minister or candidate or municipal politician or whomever is going to say, oh, there's a woman on stage with no top on. She's against advancing into the green belt. Gosh, we better get our caucus together and change our plans.
I don't think that's not what they can get from it, but it does send out the message that people do give a damn about this, especially young people. Yeah, I should put a shirt on, whatever. But I don't think it's about the boobs.
It is about the boobs in the sense that I think you're right. Again, you said a lot of things that are right today, which is not surprising, but I think you're right that it does say that some people are concerned about these things. But if you are one of the people making decisions, do you look at someone who is doing it this way and saying, yeah, but they're a lunatic. So it's the lunatic fringe that is then worried about this. We're not concerned.
No, I see people who feel powerless because I can write and write and write. And you're the same way. You have a platform. We don't change anything. Like we get some nasty letters to the editor sometimes, but even people who, you know, have kegs of ink, we have a difficult time getting messaging out. So I can't imagine people that have zero platform at all. How do you cut through the noise? And do you remember the page at Ottawa, and this is probably 20 years ago now, that had the stop sign that said Stop Harper?
Right. Yes,
it
I do.
So she said nothing. She stood there and held that sign. To me, that should be in every Canadian history book because it spoke volumes from a young person who was in there every day working for free as a page. And that was her message. So she didn't take her shirt off. So there are different routes to do this. At the time, everyone's like, oh my God, that's like sacrilegious. That's so insulting. It's like, why? Those are our buildings. This is our government. If we feel voiceless, that's a problem and that's an issue. And the fact people have to try and cut through that noise in any way possible, and sometimes they endanger themselves to do it, that means we're not listening to the people that need to be listened to. Just because I'm not rich doesn't mean a politician shouldn't take what I have to say into account.
So you are then, if I'm listening to this correctly, you are a staunch supporter then of the truckers in Ottawa because they did what they had to do to stand out.
No, because you know what? That was BS. That was, you know, they took out so many other people. That was such a selfish thing to do. Like to me, I know people that lived through that. My niece was there. It was absolutely horrible. So the people they thought they were hurting were not the people they ended up hurting. And I find it hard to believe that a single one of them singly would sign up to do that. So there's something about this group thing, which everyone can fall into. You see groups of people do things they wouldn't do on their own. But that, to me, the way that was exercised, I have issues with that.
We have heard in the last little while a lot of talk in this city about, especially in Ward 3, there are people who do not want more safe injection sites and other social services. They say we're kind of full of these things right now. We can move them somewhere else in town. We've had discussions this week or last about a condo tower at the old Delta High School. People saying we don't want this. It's going to block the sunlight and it's going to be a big problem. It's too much. And all these things, if you have something that someone wants to bring into your neighborhood, whether it's social services, whether it's high rise, whatever, if you don't want that, are you a bad person for not being understanding and selfless and you're just a NIMBY, or is this rather understandable?
I think it depends on how much effort you've put into informing yourself on what it really means. And especially with the density questions, and I'm in Burlington, I get all cranky because we've obliterated, you know, our waterfront with condos. It looks like Mississauga and Toronto. But having said that, we have to look at the world in general, and we plan our cities so poorly and so badly that people are reliant on cars, which is ridiculous. We shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't be making more cars. We should be making fewer cars. And yes, I'm writing myself out of a job as I speak. But I think we change. And I think most of the time what we're hearing from people is fear instead of understanding that building density up makes more sense. It should be on transit hubs so that people don't have to have cars. To keep putting up condos and putting two parking spaces per condo in is ridiculous. I was in Chicago a few years back and they were allotting 0.5 parking spaces in new builds for condos, which made a ton of sense to me. So think of if you could live in a downtown core and not need a car, you could walk to whatever it was you needed. And as you aged out of feeling safe driving, you would still be able to have access to everything you needed. And your kids could, you know, walk to school safely and not get mowed over Hamilton, you know, by people in monster trucks and SUVs. So I think we need to open up a little bit and understand the world is definitely changing. And there's things we could do that could make our lives better that maybe we're just scared to do because it's different than what we're doing now.
Yeah. I'm really torn on this whole idea. And I'll tell you why, because I don't want to be the person who is a NIMBY, not in my backyard, for those who don't know what I'm saying. At the same time, I kind of get it. Like if all of a sudden a tent encampment was erected on the boulevard in front of my house and garbage was everywhere and drug use was going on.
Yep.
I'm going to be very honest. I wouldn't be thrilled about that.
Oh no. So how do we come up with solutions? These people don't just end up at the bottom of the rung. They don't start there. And we've seen successive governments. I'm not going to blame one or the other. But when you start ripping away social safety nets, and yes, I'm everyone's little lefty liberal socialist, I get it. But that's okay, because we're only as good as how well we treat the people around us. And to see people struggling, and honestly, open up your eyes to the opiate crisis that is going on in this country and the country to the south of us. It is insane. And it is not bad people. It's your kid gets slipped something awful one night. And trust me, your kids are doing all this stuff just like we used to do it, but it's changed and now it's lethal and deadly. And I think, again, we find reasons why we think it wouldn't be us. But if you look and think, God, what if that was my kid? What if, you know, what if that was me? How close am I away to getting turfed out of my apartment? Rents are insane. I don't have a car to live in. Yet, if someone says to me, you're unevicted, you're gone, where do you go? There's nothing set up.
And those are the underlying issues that certainly have to be addressed. Always. But we do hear from people. We do hear from people that if you are not in agreement with encampments, that you know, you're unsympathetic, that you're an elitist, that you're this. And I'm like, I have yet to hear one person, maybe I missed it, I've yet to hear one person extend an invitation to all the people in these encampments to say, come move on to my street. I've yet to hear that.
And I think that's the problem. It's so easy. It's polarizing. The whole thing is polarizing. And if we and say that's not us. But again, how do we get a collective response to this? How do we get people to give a damn about something unless it is in their living room, if they're lucky enough to have a living room? Some people don't. I really feel we're losing touch with each other. And the internet has never made it easier to be more in touch and engaged. And yet we've gone the opposite way. We're more isolated than ever before and meaner. We're getting meaner and meaner, and it's not solving anything. And then when you throw a pandemic on top of this, and now we have interest rates and inflation, which is all stuff that we generate, but we've boiled the world and we're destroying it. And what happens when all these other countries, they're going to become unlivable, absolutely unlivable. Climate is going to be pushing them to places. And I'll tell you, we're sitting in one of the best places in the world, geographically speaking. We better smarten up and start treating people properly and have a plan in place, because otherwise we're not worthy of calling ourselves human beings. It's going to change rapidly.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
As I said, Lorraine Sommerfeld is with us today. She is the author, of course, of Motherload. She is an auto columnist with driving.ca, and as I learned when I came on the show to introduce her last hour, she is now the author of a new novel that's coming out. A new novel. What's the novel?
It's called A Face in the Window. And basically, if you've ever been a female alone at your cottage in the middle of nowhere with a kid, it will terrify you.
That's the plan. Scare the crap out of us.
Yep. I got escape convicts and a mom on her own in the middle of the woods. Wow. So, yeah, it's a thriller. I think that's what they call it. It's called a thriller. Yeah, it's totally off-piste for me. It is something I don't usually write at all. But
now, I don't expect that your life has involved many ex-convicts roaming the woods near a cottage, but is there any part of this that is, did the nugget come from something autobiographical or just totally out of the blue?
Oh, no, it did. When my oldest, who's like 31 now, I'm old, when he was a baby, I was up north on my own. We have a little cottage, you know, near Parry Sound, and I was watching, stupid me, X-Files on a Friday night. I'm up there alone with my kid. He's asleep in his little cot. I'm watching X-Files, which scares the crap out of you. The news came on, and I can't hook this up with something, so I don't know what news I was watching. But two men had escaped from a prison. And I always thought it was Petitanguishene, but I don't know that it was even invented then, so I'm not sure what I heard. But what I heard, I'm on my own, and we're in the middle of forest. Like, there's nothing. Nothing. And I'm up there on my own. I was petrified. I stayed up all night because all I thought was, if they come in here, I am doomed. I have nothing. I have to save my kid. You know, like, we don't have weapons and stuff. And so for 30 years, it sat in the back of my head. And every time I've been up there alone, every single time, I've thought of that night where I was imagining all the worst. You know, when you've got a little kid who's like 8 months old, everything is bad. Everything is bad news.
It reminds me of that. And some people may know what I'm talking about. When I went to summer camp as a kid, there was always that campfire story about the guy with the hook for a hand in the woods. And I remember that every time the campers who were new would hear that for the first time, it was like, they're not sleeping tonight.
They're not sleeping. No. Yeah. Well, no. I hope to wreck some people's cottage time this late spring when it comes out. We'll see.
Now, have you ever tried to do something like, I mean, you've written a lot, obviously you're a columnist, but have you ever tried something like this before? To write a book?
I've got three half books that were never finished, I think.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Fictions that were not done. This was the one that all came together. Like, it was like, I had the whole story and it's like, okay, this is going to work. I can make this one work. Mm. And I'm actually trying to put Motherloads together. It'll be 20 years in the fall, 20 years for Motherload.
Wow.
And readers have asked for collections of Motherloads. And even though, like,
They want a load of Motherloads.
Oh, they do. I mean, that one I do it for free. They're already written. I just need someone to get them together.
See, there's the title for your book. Motherload. The thing is, I've always thought I would love to write a book. There's just two problems. Well, three problems. One is I don't have time. That's a big one. Number two, I don't have a good idea that I really have come up with yet that I have thought. And that seems to me to be almost the hardest part, is to find the nugget that you start to build around. And three, every time I read like a John Grisham book or something, maybe it's because I work in the business of writing, but over and over in my head, all I can think of is this is so complicated to try and write this. How do you keep track of the characters and who's coming and who's going, and how many times you have to go and read this stupid book over again for proofreading? It's one thing to read a 18 or 19 inch column five times to make sure you've got it right. But if it's 400 pages, my goodness, I don't know. How do you do it?
That was incredibly difficult. And it's the longest thing I've ever completed. Like, as you said, I've written a lot of words for a lot of years, but I had sheets because I had to have maps. It takes place in Upper New York State, the Finger Lakes region. So I had maps, topography, geography, the climate, the time of year. You have to have, if you have a character who is traveling from here to here, you have to see what time of day he did it, where the sun was it raining, how far would it take you to walk there. So I drove down there a couple times because I like that part of the state. But you've got all these plates spinning, and then you go back and you read it and you go, oh, you idiot, that they can't get, you left them off here, and then now all of a sudden they've magically floated over, 10 miles away. So there's a lot of loose ends and strings. And when I'm reading a book, when I find one of those, it turns me off the whole book. So I'm gambling here, folks. Like, if I, if I turn you off with one loose end, I'm going to look like an idiot. But
I mean, the beauty of fiction, and again, not, I mean, I'm just blowing smoke down, speaking out of my butt because I've never done it. But the beauty of fiction, at least, is that if there is something that doesn't quite exactly fit accurately, you can say it was, creative license, as opposed to writing about a biography of someone or something. But nonetheless, you're right. There will be people. I mean, if again, I'll use the example because everybody reads like John Grisham or something. If he wrote a book that was based in Toronto and said, I walked from the CN Tower to North York City Hall. Yep. Everyone would go, what are you, an idiot? Like, it'll take you a day and a half. Well, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, you have to be really, really careful because people... I care about that stuff. And a lot of readers do too. Like, something will just bother you. And once it bugs you, it's like a little loose thread, and it will bug, all the rest of it will bother you. So you have to be careful. And my publisher is actually in New York. So I would write something. He goes, what, is that a Canadian thing? I'm going,
yeah, well.
So, and you can't have any wasted characters. You can't have someone in there just because. Everyone has to have something to do. So.
See, that's the other reason why I've never written fiction yet, because I would be the guy who would want to, just because, I want to be a jerk about it a little bit. I want to introduce a character and kill them off one page later, just to have you wonder, why in the world did he bother to introduce that person? Just, because.
I kind of did that.
Oh, well, we'll wait to read it. Hopefully it's not the face in the window.
Hey, well, no, the publisher, the first time he read it, he said to me, he goes, I can't believe how harsh you are.
Well, so when does this book come out?
Late spring. I don't have a date yet.
Like this year, so, like within months?
Yes. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see some noise about it in the spec. Somebody over there has got to review it for me, Graham.
Well, somebody might. Jeff. Yeah. Somebody will. Yeah. Well, speaking of fiction, there was a piece that you wrote this week. It was this week, right? I think it was this week. March 9th. Sorry, March 9th. So late last week.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's fiction. It's not fiction, but it's about fiction in a sense, because I love this piece. Press once for yes, press 100 times for no. We are surrounded by a world where buttons are not connected to anything, but we are led to believe they are. And there is a picture that goes with it of a poor schmo pushing one of those buttons to turn the light green at the crosswalk that,
Yeah,
I think you have touched on something that everybody believes, and yet we all, because we've been led to believe in that, we're not being misled. I think most of us think, well, it's got to do something. It's got to do something, even though we have no evidence to support that.
I know, we're so trusting. We're just children. Like, you push a button and the elevator will come. And I know if you push it once, it will, apparently. But when people walk up right after you and push it again, they get a little side eye from me. It's like, do
you
know
what I'm saying? You just blew the whole thing.
Exactly. It's like, this is crazy. And it actually came to me because I was in Quebec City, actually, on the weekend for a couple of days, which was lovely. But in the hotel room, the thermostat, and hotel thermostats are the bane of my existence. I do not believe they are attached to anything. I think it's a little box they put on the wall in every room with buttons so you can think you're doing it, because they know by the time you figure out it's a joke, you're leaving.
Yes. So yes.
That's my thing. Thermostats, there's no way. They're not attached to anything. It's just to let people believe they have some kind of control.
Yeah. We were in a hotel in Florida a while back, and we thought the same about the air conditioner because you could turn it on. There was no question it would go on and off. It worked that way, but then it had low, medium, high, whatever, and it didn't matter what. It was either going 1,000,000% where the air felt like you were having Santa Claus blow down the back of your shirt, or it was nothing.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, I don't believe that there's anything here. But see, I like the idea. I wish, and here's the flip side of this. I wish more than anything that if you went up and pressed the elevator button like 5 times really fast, each time you press it, it sped up the elevator that much. See, you imagine how much fun that would be in the elevator? You're just flying.
Best story I've got, I forgot before I wrote this column. When my kid was little, we went to the fire station for a field trip. And I was talking to some of the firemen. I was one of the mommies that went in, and they've got a light out front, like a traffic light, so that when they got to go, they push the button and the doors go up and that light changes to red immediately. There's no wait because they have to, take off. While we're standing there talking, one of the little kids in preschool is pushing the button and we didn't know. And apparently out front, the light was stopping, like going on and off and on and off and on and off until one of the firefighters looked over and went, oh crap, this little 4-year-old just jamming away. So in that case, the button worked, which I should have put in the column, but usually they don't.
It really is though, as I say, excuse me, it really is one of these things that's almost like a test for us of, are you willing to trust this? Like it's almost a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like it's supposed to mollify us somehow. Well, if we make you think that you're having an impact on something, you'll feel better about waiting.
And then we can go back to all the misinformation from the governments. Like if we believe we're being heard, then it'll shut us up. So yeah, it's dope for the masses. Buttons that aren't attached to anything.
Yes. We don't like having no control. So here you feel like you've got some control, even though it's, it's nothing.
Well, it's like when your kid in those little toys they have where the kid's got a steering wheel in the car, a toy.
Yes. Yeah. Or go to Disney World and drive those cars on the one thing. And
a wacky track. Yeah.
And you can't steer the car for the life of you. It doesn't do anything. But you feel like, the kid gets to drive the car and they feel like they're in control. And
everyone's a rock star. Yeah.
I wonder who, and I don't think you touched on this in the column. I'll have to read it again. But I wonder who came up with the idea for this kind of thing. Because, and maybe once upon a time, Lorraine, honestly, maybe once upon a time, this stuff really did work more when there was less traffic and less cars going by so that, you could press the light. But I don't know if it ever was something that was useful or if it's always been like this.
Well, do you remember we used to tell each other which lights you rolled your tires on to that, one stripe because you'd watch police cars do it and you go, that's how they change the light. And we trade around all these probably old wives' tales, or urban legends is probably more correct. But some lights, they're on a timer, folks. You press and it's not going to do anything. But again, you want to feel like you're doing something. So we keep doing it. But now I think of all the tips and tricks that we used to tell each other for making stuff happen. And we're boring and we're dumb.
All right. I'm going to tell you one though that really does work. And I'm not being urban legend here. And I'm telling you, try this on your way home today or tonight or something. All right. If you pull up to a light that has an advanced green and you're coming up to the red light and it's red against you and you're the only car in the turn lane,
sit back,
stay back one car length because the reader or whatever it is, if there's just one car, it doesn't do it. But if there's more than one, it changes the light. I'm telling you, it works.
You're absolutely right. I've got a bunch of intersections around me and that works. And some people get mad when they see that someone's sitting in the second position, but I would rather go one car on an advanced than someone going on the yellow or late. It's way safer. So if you see someone doing it, don't get mad at them. It's a safer way to make the turn. I'll take that hat off now.
Yeah, but it's true. For people listening, if you're out in your car right now and you're coming up to a red light and there's an advanced green, so you're going to like at some point get the advanced green, and you're the only car in the turn lane, sit back one car length and you will get the light to change. I'm telling you.
Be the second car.
Be the second car. It needs multiple cars and it'll make it happen.
But pull up. If someone comes behind you, pull up. Don't, let everyone get around the light. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I do wonder about the other side of this, though, the human. So we have the idea with these buttons that we want to feel in control. What I really don't understand, though, is what you talked about with the elevator, that we think that somehow if we press it multiple times, that somehow there's a person like the old phone operators, the women in the room plugging from things, and they okay, it's been pressed six times. We better make the elevator come down. We better hurry it up. Like, I don't even understand the psychology that would make someone think if I just multiple press it and it's already lit up, something will happen.
Well, I think it's probably because we have nothing to do. When you're standing there, it's awkward. Like when you get in an elevator with people and nobody talks. I've gotten in and stood and faced the back of the elevator just because I like to cause trouble. That messes people up.
And no kidding. So I think you're a psycho.
So, oh yeah, no, I get an elevator, the other people get out. Like usually, you know. But I think if they put big Sudokus on the wall or something, everybody got to group do them. Maybe they'd have something to do. Wouldn't push the button so many times. I don't know.
this is entirely childish. I will acknowledge this is not an endorsement of my maturity level. But there are YouTube videos where people have a fart maker, a sound maker, or the smell stuff, the really bad smell stuff. Oh. And they will go on an elevator, videotape it like it's for YouTube. And what's amazing to me, this is totally not to do with buttons, I suppose, but you mentioned elevators. Half the people, when they make the noise or fire off the smell, half the people think it's hilarious. Yeah. And the other half are enraged and ready to kill these people. And it's like, I wonder what that says about your personality, which one you would be. If some guy gets onto the elevator and it's just a few of you and all of a sudden you hear a pfft, are you thinking, oh, that's hysterical, as long as I don't have to go to floor 207. Right. Or if you're thinking, that pig, I don't know.
Getting hot boxed with a...
Yeah, it is. Really cool. It is an interesting psychological study, though. The piece is called "Press Once for Yes, Press 100 Times for No Reason." That's Lorraine's piece that was from last week. It's a really fun read. Lorraine, I saw this story the other day, and my first reaction was, "Well, that's bonkers." The headline from CNBC: WWE, as in the wrestling entertainment, WWE in talks with state gambling regulators to legalize betting on scripted match results. So you can now wager on who you think is going to win when the winner has already been decided before they go into the ring. And then I thought, well, wait a second, you can wager on the Academy Awards, who's going to win. And that's been pre-decided. So it may not be quite as bonkers as I initially thought. Neither one is the point, though. I'm simply wondering, this is just another example to me that it seems gambling ads, gambling, everything right now has become everywhere. It's almost pervasive. Have we gotten to the point where there is too much emphasis being put on gambling in our society?
Oh, absolutely. And to the detriment of all of us, gambling is a huge, huge problem. We've talked earlier about, you know, drug overdoses and opioid epidemics and things like that. Gambling is an addiction, just like those things are.
Well, can and to put them on, yes.
Oh, absolutely can be. But to make it so accessible and so easy and online in your hand, if you've ever lived with somebody that has, you know, control issues when it comes to like self-control, to make it, at least then you had to get dressed and go out to a casino or something or find a card game. Now I sound like I'm in a 1940s movie or something. Yeah. But anyone who will gamble on, people that will gamble on a coin toss or like everything about the Oscars, whatever, people that like to gamble will gamble about anything. And people who are in trouble do not need to have it served up to them on a silver platter every time they turn around. And I have been familiar with people who have struggled with this in their life, and the people that live with them are shaking their heads going, how can we ever begin to, you know, be able to put some boundaries around this when there's too many people making too much money to ever listen to the long-term fallout from this? And it is going to be long-term fallout. I think it's devastating. It's going to devastate families.
Let me there's a very big part of me that agrees with you, by the way, but let me just play devil's advocate for a second, because we had and have had for as long as I can remember, since I was a kid, when I would watch Hockey Night in Canada, sponsored by Molson Canadian, almost all the commercials would be for beer on hockey. It's either beer or it's some seltzer, or it's, hey, we don't drink beer anymore, we all drink you know, liquor now, whatever else. Oh, there are a ton of commercials. It used to be cigarette commercials on there. But do the alcohol commercials have it? Has it led to everybody becoming addicted to booze, becoming an alcoholic? So if it hasn't, then why would gambling be different?
Part of the thing I believe here in Ontario and in Canada is our booze is a lot more expensive. There's parts of the states you can get a coupon. You can go to these liquorterias, like these great big huge stores.
That's a word.
My mind is blown. I'm like, oh my God. And it's cheap. Like it's
Costco.
Crazy cheap.
You can get it at Costco.
Oh yeah. And I remember in another lifetime, I used to run sports teams, a certain kind. And we had sponsorship from a cigarette company and a beer company. And then the laws were changed and we lost our main sponsor because they could no longer do a sporting thing with their advertising dollars. So they had to find somewhere else to spend it. We survived and it was okay because our sport was predominantly, I mean, our athletes were, you know, teenagers. So it made sense. Pro athletes shouldn't be pushing cigarettes. Like it's just silly. So I personally, it cost me money, but I knew it was the right thing to do. And that didn't make me angry, but you can argue that everyone's an adult and can make all their own decisions. That's fine. But at what age are we going to say that maybe kids are being exposed to stuff they shouldn't be? I don't like seeing weed shops on every corner. And I have no problem with weed, frankly. I would rather you never have to wrestle the car keys from someone who's high on weed. You just don't. So I'd take it over booze any day, frankly, when it comes to arguing with somebody. But I think we have a job and an obligation to everybody, not just our personal selves. I could walk into a casino and walk out 20 minutes later. A, I hate it. Noisy people, can't stand it. But I don't have a problem with that. But that doesn't mean other people don't. So I think we have to put up better guardrails around these things.
And here's the thing. I tend to be a little more, you know what, if you're as what you just described, if you're an adult and you want to do it, fine. My one of the issues that I have with this is not even so much the fact that you can gamble, although I know other people would say, no, that's a big deal. Look, people can, they're going to do it, but it's the pervasive nature of the advertising of it that it just seems like, again, you cannot watch a sporting event without having 50 gambling ads come on at some point. You can't, it's in your face nonstop. If you want to gamble, and people have always gambled, even before it was legal, they've always found a way to do it.
Yeah.
It, to me, it's the commercials that just, and to the point they drive me nuts. When I'm watching, if I'm watching Hockey Night in Canada and in the intermission, they go to Cabbie for some update on what or someone else. It's like, I don't need that. I don't want that. You're pushing some, it's the commercials more than anything that are driving me bonkers on this stuff.
But I think you're answering your own question kind of, which is there's too much, it's saturated. That means it's working. People are getting rich off this and it's not the people.
Oh, there's money in it. Oh yeah. There's money in it.
And people that are gambling aren't making the money. And we all know that it's stupid. The house wins. But when the law was changed in this province, I heard like on subways and transit everywhere, the ads all over the place. And people are going, this is crazy. But to me, it makes us, it's ripping us down to this lowest common denominator of a bunch of Pavlovian dogs. Like, is this really what we want to be? Is booze in corner stores, gambling things on every site, weed things on every corner? Come on, we're better than this, especially a government who had previously, this leader is, you know, would love gladly to tear down every library. Come on, we're better than this.
But Lorraine, didn't we start an hour ago? And again, if people are just tuning in, they can go back and listen to this online later. But we were talking about social media. I think this is all tied together. Social media has built us to be addicts, not necessarily to gambling, but to dopamine. We need that hit every 10 seconds of hearing our phone ding or getting a like or whatever else. This is the same. I don't know if a doctor would say medically, but it's the same thing that you need that hit of dopamine of something exciting, something that happens. It all seems to me to tie in together. So it's no surprise that this industry is so huge right now.
Well, I mean, as they figured out how our brains work, they could figure out ways to exploit that. I remember talking to a parents group like 15 years ago and explaining that they said, well, how come my kid won't put their phone down? Or their computer if they're playing games. I go, that notification, that ding, ding, it sets off the exact same receptor that booze and drugs do in your brain. It travels the same pathway. And I said, your kid's not the only one doing it. You're doing it. People cannot leave their phone alone. I'm like, don't put your phone beside your bed. Like, just don't. It's terrible. And we entertain this a lot because of the driving stuff I do, which is people driving with their phones. Is there anything worse? This is why people are getting mowed over. Everyone's so distracted. Trying to get people to put their phones down, they might miss a notification or a ding, except their brain is wired to make them happy about that. So I can't even say to them, you're just stupid. It's like, no, you have to make a conscious effort to go against what your brain chemistry is offering you up.
Yeah, we got to take a break here. I don't know why someone has not, maybe they have. I don't know why someone has not created an app that just randomly dings your phone every few seconds just to make you feel happy. So I'm sure it's out there, but if they haven't, hey, there's $1 million idea for someone, because people would love that stuff.
More notifications, great.
More notifications. And just all they got to do is say, hi, just making you look important for your friends. So Lorraine, I saw this study that came out on March the 1st, and this is one that flies in the face of every proverb that we've ever been told. The study says earning more money does make people happier. Up to now, the study was sort of specific. It was done in the States, so maybe it's an American thing only and not Canadian, although I doubt it. Up to making $500,000 annually, it does boost your happiness. After that, maybe they couldn't find the rich people or they didn't get good answers, but it's sort of, we don't really know what happens after $500,000. But as you're making more money, if you make up to $500,000, the more you make, apparently the happier you are. You buy that?
Oh, absolutely. I buy that.
Really?
I do. And maybe back in 50 years ago, I wouldn't know if I think it was different. But with this giant gulf between the people who make way more than enough, billionaires shouldn't exist, and people who are scrambling, I think it's incredibly insulting to tell somebody who can't pay their hydro bill or know if their rent is going to be paid that a little more money wouldn't be helping them out. I think that's so condescending. Of course, more money would help people out. They'd feel safe. They'd feel secure. Their mental health would be better. Absolutely. If you can cover your butt and know that your kids are going to be fed, you can't tell me that will not make you happier.
I know. I agree.
Not buy it.
Yep. I agree with that. I agree with the idea that, look, if you are struggling to get by, that having the money to pay your bills and eat and everything clearly is going to have that impact. No one is going to, I don't think anyone's happy struggling or being really, really poor. I believe that. But where I found this weird, or I guess, is like, okay, so let's say you make $100,000 a year, so you can pay your rent, and I assume you can, depending on what kind of place you get or your mortgage, but $200,000, you make $200,000 a year, okay? I can't imagine if you're making $200,000 a year, you can't find some place to live that you can afford and eat. But for it to continue going up, like to me, I would have expected there would have been a point at which, you know, I just feel the same, whether it's 250 or 500. But apparently this says, no, it really nudges up with each level of increase. I was surprised by that part.
I think depending on where they did this study and stuff, like there's a big difference between living in Oklahoma and New York City.
True.
And I personally know people, Americans, who haven't had children because they can't afford to have children. And that is crazy to me. If you want one that badly, you should be able to. But I think we've got this flexible thing about what enough is. And what used to be enough was someone could be home with the kids, or the kids could, you know, be in a safe place while you worked. You could go on a vacation every year, you know, like that would be a thing. You weren't one car repair away from maxing out your visa. Like that wasn't a thing. And we've gotten really, really far away from what used to just be ideal or what used to be enough. And now we look at that, and so many people are paycheck to paycheck. They're not that far away from a disaster, especially medically. And I don't want to go that way up here like they have in the States. One heart attack, you lose your house, you know, if you have no insurance. So I think we've pushed the dial on what is enough. And a lot of people now, younger people, they can't even think about retiring. Like that's not going to happen. So when did it become what my parents could manage to do? That would seem like tons now. That would just be extraordinary. He was a steel worker and mom was home with us. That we had a cottage. We could, you know, well, we couldn't go on vacation anywhere except Saskatchewan, and that was just punishment. But,
it really, so, though, I mean, what you're talking about is just how much we've changed and, you know, keeping up. I mean, this is no longer about, you know, for a lot of people, about getting ahead. It's just about keeping up. And again,
that's it.
But okay, so how much then do you think of this? And again, I think we've both agreed on the idea, okay, having enough to live, just the basics to be able to pay bills. That's one thing. Beyond that, though, if this study says as you go up, you continue to get happier, how much of this would you say is just based on pure envy? That if I see Lorraine, who's got the nice car and the bigger house than me and goes on vacations, I may be able to pay all my bills and do everything, but I don't have what she has. Therefore, I'm not happy because I'm not equal to her.
If my kids are any indication, I think the generations coming in, I think there's less of that. What we want is to feel safe and secure. And we want our family to be safe as well. So I see that 500,000 to me, I can't even imagine a number that big every year. Like I don't make a lot of money. I did not pick a lucrative route, but that's okay. I'm happy. But I don't think it's the envy thing, because most people just want to feel safe and secure within their own home that they can count on and know if they get sick or hurt and can't go to work for some reason. Like so many people are hauling themselves into work sick because they have no choice. This is all sideways. This is all crazy. We're making ourselves unhealthy. And I don't think most people want $500,000 a year. I think they want to not be terrified every morning when they wake up. And more people are in that position. And it's taking more and more out of them. The safety and security is slipping away from under people. And that's, you want to talk about levels of depression and everything. God, I'm just a ray of sunshine, aren't I?
Well, Lorraine, it's so funny because, you know, when you say you can't imagine 500,000, nor can I, believe it or not, only Bill Kelly makes that much money at 900 CHML. And Bill makes $6 million a year. I'm giving it away, but that's, you know, but there was a signing of a quarterback in the NFL the other day, and he's okay. He's not a superstar. Nobody would call him a superstar. He just signed a new deal for 3 years for $40 million per year for 3 years. And I don't know about you. I don't know if you've ever done this. I certainly have. Knowing I'm never going to have money like that, I have laid in bed and thought, if I ever won the lottery and won $10 million, what would I do with it? And the idea that they would give you essentially almost a paycheck for $1 million a week. I mean, it's a little less than that, obviously. We can do the math. But that you would go to your locker and get a check for $1 million. I can't imagine $1 million.
I know.
And okay, so let's say, and again, we're getting way off track here, but let's say I got $1 million. There are a few things that I would spend, I would use it on. And then I buy pretty much everything that I would want. And then the next week they give me another $1 million. And I'm like, oh man, okay. And now, oh, I better get that boat and I can get and then within a month, I've got the house, I've got the cottage, I've got the boat, I've got the car, and then they give me another $1 million. I mean, it's bizarre how much money there is out there for some people. And, you know, it flabbergasts me. I have no idea how you would even contemplate that kind of stuff.
I think I know some rich people, believe it or not, and kind of turning this on its head, are they markedly more happy than people I know who aren't rich? I'm talking lots and lots of money, and they're not, because at some point your things own you. Like you're so responsible for that cottage and that boat and all that stuff. So I think people who can find a way to find security and safety and then live simply, those are the happiest people I know. And that's not about it. That's not an outsized salary. That is something that provides safety and security. And then they live simple. And I don't want to. That's my goal.
Yeah. No, and I don't want to sound like Mother Teresa, because this is not about like patting myself, but I really, one of the things that I have thought of when in those moments when I dream about, or just imagine, because you're falling asleep, the people that you could help. Like imagine having that much money and how you could apply it if it was in your possession to do. Like, I've thought of this before. If I was a professional baseball player, if I was someone who was, you know, in that world, and I'm now in the negotiations for a contract and it's going to be, you know, 20 or whatever million dollars, do I push hard for an extra 5 million with people now thinking I'm greedy because I'm, you know, I'm holding out on my team, but knowing, well, that 5 million though, think of what I could do with that 5 million for people. That's just going to go into the owner's pocket.
And I, to me, that's set up. If I won lottery, lots of money, set up a foundation immediately. I don't need much. And my kids would be looking after that, giving it away and finding ways to make sure it stays there and that the right people are deciding where this goes. And unfortunately, I think it sucks that we need philanthropy to build hospitals and schools and libraries. That's nonsense. Those things should be just at an integral level of our culture. But lots of people with money get to put their name on a building, and that's cool. Makes them feel good. But you're right. I think I was raised that charity is anonymous. My mom said, you never put your name on a big check ever. She was just like, you don't do it. And there's so many good people in this community doing so many quiet little things all the time. And I really, this is a shout out to any of you that are doing those really nice things for people. I don't care if it's small. The fact you're doing it, you're doing stuff the right way, whether it's shoveling, paying for someone's groceries, helping them out. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Those are the heroes we need, because people that make $40 million a year and then do something splashy, well, you know, whatever. I have a lot more time for the small people doing things.
And probably, you know, I get that for sure. Although, you know what, we do have a lot of facilities in the city because people who had a lot of money did that too, and they didn't have to. So I
appreciate it. They saved my life. That's right. I appreciate it. But I think we're not structured right.
Lorraine Sommerfeld. Well, you know what is going to be structured right, I'm told, is her new novel. Tell us the name of it again so people can look for it when it comes out. How's that for a segue? What was the name of the novel again?
A Face in the Window, and you can't find it anywhere yet. But
no, but keep an eye out for it. And we'll talk about it when it's on. When it comes out, we'll talk about it on the show for sure, so people know where to get it. Lorraine, appreciate you doing this today. Thanks for your time.
It's been fun. Have a good night.
That is Lorraine Sommerfeld, author of Motherload, autocolumnist with driving.ca, and yes, a future novelist.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.